All right, so that looks good. So this is Bio 241, and it's the first session in the spring semester. And this is Dr. Gober, so welcome to class. And I want to talk about how maybe you can add this class if you need to add the class. The way that you get into this class is by finding availability in a lab sections. So you have to go to a lab, and the lab instructor will take roll call almost when the class starts. And if there are no-shows, then we will drop those students because it is mandatory that you attend the first lab and lecture every semester so that we can maximize enrollment here at the college. And if somebody gets dropped, if there's a no-show, then that lab instructor will hold some kind of lottery to replace those students that didn't show up to class. Okay, so since I don't know what the enrollment is in the labs because some people don't show up, I can't issue any add codes in lecture. So the way you find your way into lecture is by finding a spot in lab. And once you register for lab, you're automatically then enrolled in lecture. So you see we got a few empty seats right here in this big lecture hall, but we don't have any extra seats at all in lab. So you got to find that spot in lab, and then you're welcome to join our class right here. Okay, so if you're... And the other policy is that only officially registered students can attend class. All right, so if you're not officially registered in the class, I'm going to actually have to ask you to leave because I don't want to mislead anybody to think that they're actually enrolled in the class. You really have to persevere and find your way into a section, a lab section. Okay, so I'm sorry about that. Check the schedule of classes, but my labs for this class are either at 8 o'clock on Tuesday or Thursday, or at 1 o'clock on Tuesday and Thursday. And I think the room number is 316. All right, so good luck, everybody. Fine, I hope you can get a spot in lab. All right, so let's go over Blackboard real quick, because you'll find some important study materials in Blackboard. Here's the URL. It's not www, it's just straight cypresscollege.blackboard.com. Right, here's your login information, and when you log in, as a matter of fact, can I see a show of hands? Who's logged into Blackboard sometime in their life? A lot of people, all right, so I'm not going to spend too much time, but for those of you that haven't, we'll just do it really quick one time. All right, and sorry for you people in the front row, it's really hard to see the screen. We're eventually going to have a screen that comes all the way down to here and from wall to wall, but I don't know when that's going to happen. All right, so in this spot right here, all right, you have to put your student ID number, starting with the ampersand, all right? And so my student number is, actually, I take classes here, but there's part of it. Uh-oh. Blue screen of death. Okay, and then just tab down and put your password in. That's the password that you use in WebStar. It usually transfers over. All right, and then hit a return. Ah, returned. That's really nice when it works. All right, so here's Blackboard, and you probably aren't taking all these classes that I'm teaching this semester, but you're going to have probably a couple of them. All right, so this is a physiology class, maybe 22224. I think that's a good one. That pertains to somebody right here. All right, and what do we have? We got course information, like the welcome letter I sent out and the course syllabus. You should download this course syllabus to your computer. How would you do that? A good way to do it is notice that the cursor changes from an arrow to a pointy hand, finger on a hand. Right-click. And it's going to say save target as or save something as, say save target as. And then you can put it someplace on your computer. Should we put it here in Dr. Goshi's file folder? Get him confused? No, because I maybe want it. All right, so desktop, do a little shortcut to my folder. This is 241. Let's put it here, spring 210. Save it. All right, so that didn't take very long. What else are we want to look at? I'll show you some more things about Blackboard in just a little bit. All right, what else? Course documents. All right, lecture PowerPoint slides. Here's for today's lab, but I think you get that in lab. Here's the PowerPoint for today's lecture. Again, if you want to put this on your computer, what should you do? Right click, save target as. All right, and we'll put it Spring 210. There's a good file name, say save. All right, I don't know what our download speeds are, but pretty reasonable here. Okay. So that's how you would use Blackboard. Under control, no, under tools, eventually you're going to find something that's going to say my grades, and you can go in there and check your grades at any time. So your lab instructors will load the quiz grades into Blackboard, and I'll load your exam grades into Blackboard so you'll know pretty much exactly where you are in the class at any particular time. All right. All right. Assignments is also very handy, because there are exam study guides right here. It tells you what online questions from the publisher's website that I like, that you can practice over and over and over and over again. What questions at the end of the chapters I like to help you learn the information in the chapters, as well as exam figures that you should memorize, right? That you can practice labeling. And it's sort of like anatomy, but these are going to be flow diagrams that allow you to interrelate various organs with their functions. So these are exam figures that you mostly have in your textbook or other ones that I provide for you in class. So you can print these out and practice them maybe 100 times if you want to. And if you practice them 100 times, guess what? You're probably going to get 100% on the test. All right. Now, anybody know Bruce Lee? Who's Bruce Lee? He was a martial artist, right? He was an athlete. And he said something about how it took him to learn something, whether it was a kick or a punch or a block in martial arts. He said he would have to practice it. How many times would he have to practice a move? Because he actually wrote a number of books about how to learn martial arts. How many times did he have to practice a move before he really understood what it was all about? I don't know if anybody read any of his books. We have a hand up there. 2,000 times. That's probably why he was the best in the world. Okay? You probably don't have to read your textbook 2,000 times. Maybe not even 1,000 times. All right? But it's going to be a lot more than one time. Okay? So that's just a little advice from Bruce Lee. Okay? And previous students tell me the same thing. When you try to learn new information, repetition is the key. All right? All right, so these are important study guides. All right, so you can find your syllabus. If somebody can't get to this information, access to Blackboard is not a prerequisite or a requisite of the class. If you need any of this information during the class, all right, I'll provide it for you during office hours. Right, so if you don't have a computer at home or a printer or whatever, I'll provide that information for you. All right, so that's a little bit about Blackboard. I don't know why the tools didn't pop open. It did now. Okay, so you would just check my grades, and you'd be able to check all of your grades in there. Okay, and since I'm not a student, there's nothing in my grades. Probably give me an error message. Good, as it should. Okay, because I don't have grades in the class. All right, so let's start talking about the class. All right, so I created a folder here called Spring 2010. Which you should have on your computer as well. All right, and we're going to start looking at some PowerPoint slides. And if you don't have PowerPoint on your computer, you can use a link in Blackboard to get a PowerPoint viewer program, which is free. So you can view these PowerPoints. Okay, you just can't print them out in a very convenient way. The way I like to print them out is maybe 4 per slide, 4 per piece of paper. All right, in the PowerPoint viewer, it has to be one slide per piece of paper, which is handy if you can afford the ink to print it out that way. All right, so here's me, chapter 1. So you should start actually reading through and become very familiar with chapter 1 this week, and over the weekend start on chapter 2. All right, maybe next time I can spend a little bit of time on the syllabus, but I'll give you this week to print it out and read it over yourself. Right. All right, so let's see. How do we get the slideshow going? Right here. All right, so this is just an introductory chapter where we talk about some miscellaneous topics and actually broach the topic which is really important in physiology, and that is how the body controls itself. All right, so human physiology. You probably know what physiology means. It's a scientific study of something. What is physiology the scientific study of? Yeah, the functioning and particular of the human body is what we're most interested in this class. Right, we're not going to talk much in terms of other animal models, but we're going to talk about human physiology. And what is a nice companion scientific study to physiology, which is a prerequisite for this class? Anatomy. And what is anatomy? Yeah, it's the scientific study of the structure of the human body. Right, physiology is the function. Right, and you're going to see that there is a very important relationship between structure and function. And we have you take the anatomy class first because the anatomy determines what the physiology can be. So if we change the structure of the human body, what necessarily has to change as well? The function, right? So anatomy determines what the physiology can be. Right, so you can just think of your hand, for instance. You can grasp something because why can you grasp something like a pencil or something like that? Because you have an opposable thumb. You have a thumb that can move right anteriorly to the palm of your hand so that you can grasp something. But maybe you're a worker all like me. I worked in a sheet metal factory for years and years and years and worked punch presses and things like that. And what if I would have made a mistake and chopped off a thumb, what would happen to the function of that hand? Well, it would change. I couldn't grasp anything with that hand, right? So the structure determines what the function of that part of the body is, right? And that's going to be, you're going to see that's the same on the gross anatomical level, at the level of cells, and even at the level of molecules. If you change the structure of a molecule, you're going to change what the function of that molecule is in your body. Okay. And when it changes, it might not produce a beneficial change in physiology. It might produce a disease state. And we need to study that disease state. And what is the scientific study of disease states in the human body called? That's what we call pathophysiology. All right? So that's how physiological processes, when they're altered, right, cause disease or injury. All right? So I want you to know physiology versus pathophysiology, and we're going to pay attention to both. All right, so the first topic is a scientific method. Maybe some of you have looked at scientific method, and even today, even though I was a scientist for many, many years, even today when I think of the scientific method, I find it tedious and arduous and kind of boring, okay, because of all the steps that you have to rigorously adhere to all the time. So the important question is, why do we put up with something that's tedious and arduous and maybe even boring at times? What's the purpose of using the scientific method? And you should copy this down because it's important to know all the little details, but you should also remember the big idea. What's the big idea with scientific method? Why do people spend their lives being very meticulous, learning statistics, for instance, keeping very accurate records? What's the purpose of scientific method? It's to give you, or humanity, reliable information. Information that you can count on. All right, so, for instance, that is very important. Because in here I'm going to say you're going to have 5 lecture exams. And for me, you take that as being reliable information. But what if I told you, oh, you know what, you're going to have 25 exams in here. And I'm just kidding. Right, that's not reliable information. You'd probably get up and leave and maybe find another instructor, right? So having reliable information that you can count on is very important, especially when it comes to medicine, because you're relying on that information to what? Save your life, for instance. So the scientific method is really important because it's information that you can count on. And in particular, you're going to find some pretty amazing things in your textbook and during the class, and might even be a little bit unbelievable. All right? But everything in your textbook is there because it has worked its way through the scientific method, and it is reliable and accurate information. whether it's talking about drug interactions or certain kinds of therapies or how your heart functions, right? All the information in your book is reliable because it's gone through the scientific method. All right, so what is this process of scientific method? Well, first, all right, somebody that's kind of interested in the natural environment looks around, lives their everyday life, and they kind of have a hunch about how the natural world operates. Like if you don't sleep for a week, right, say you get up Monday morning and you stay awake until Saturday, you have a hunch by the time Saturday comes around, you're pretty much worthless, right? You can never pass a test, that you're just not as sharp, right? So that's just a hunch, right? But it's not proved by any kind of scientific method. So by your everyday experience, scientific method starts with that inclination that you have some kind of understanding how the world is operating or how your body is operating. Right, so that's what we call a hypothesis. So a hypothesis is untested. It's just a hunch. It's a guess. Would you call a hypothesis reliable information? No, it's just a guess. Oh, I'm running out of voice already. Wow. Might be a long semester. All right, so a hypothesis is just kind of a guess based on your everyday observations. But it has to be testable in order to be part of the scientific method. All right, I won't be able to talk quite so loud. So, can the scientific method answer a question, for instance, like, is there God or not? Because it can't be tested, right? You can answer that question based on faith, but not through scientific method. So those are two totally different kinds of ways of thinking and discipline. So science really can't describe anything about religion or faith-based kinds of considerations. They're just opposite kinds of endeavors. Okay, although people try to mix them together all the time. All right, so how do you test a hypothesis or a guess? It's by conducting experiments and analyzing experiments, which means then that that hypothesis is testable. Okay, so then you get results from these various tests, and then you can draw conclusions onto whether or not they support your hypothesis. And if it supports your hypothesis, and if these tests can be repeated by various people all over the world under the same circumstances, okay, then a theory can develop, right? And a theory is just a proved general statement explaining some natural phenomena which is based on a proven hypothesis. All right, so if I say I have a hypothesis about something, and then I say I have a theory about something, what are you going to really pay attention to? The theory, because it's what? The hypothesis that's been proved by a number of experiments. So theory is much more important, has much more power for your everyday life. So what we see in our books are theories, not hypotheses. And if I ever mention something in class that isn't proven by the scientific method or by experiments, I'll be sure to tell you it's a hypothesis and not a theory. All right, so if you're a scientist, you're interested in hypotheses because it's fun trying to prove them or disprove them, right? But if you're just living your everyday life, what do you want to know? The proven hypotheses or the theories? So a lot of times you'll be talking with your friends, you'll say, oh, well, I've got a theory about something. Okay, if we do this and this and this, I bet this is going to be the end result. But in most cases, what should they be saying? I have a hypothesis about how we should proceed. But nobody really ever says that, unfortunately, because it's such a big, long, right, gangly word. But you should probably use that. All right, so what does testing a hypothesis involve? Experiments. All right, if you want to do an experiment, you take a population of a number of individuals, and they should all be identical individuals. All right, and then you break them up into two groups. One is going to be the experimental group, which you perform the experiment on, and the other half of that group you won't perform the experiment on. We call that the control group. So the control group gets shouldn't change, right? So you got to have two groups. Now, that's difficult with people. Why is that difficult with people? Why is it difficult to take maybe 100 people and break them up into two identical groups? Because you can't find two people that are identical, much less take 100 people and break them up into two different groups, right? So scientific method with humans is, from that point of view, a little difficult, and you always have to consider that. As opposed to if you're going to do some experiments on maybe a muscle cell. Well, you can take a muscle cell and grow it in culture, and you can end up with millions of muscle cells that are all identical. Or maybe you want to do experiments out with mice. And has anybody seen what experimental mice look like? They're all white. They all have pink ears, pink eyes. Basically, they're all identical. They're all basically clones of each other. All right, so using experimental models like mice or tissues or cells is relatively easy. But when it comes to people, it's difficult because we're all so different. All right, and then you perform the experiment, and then you make measurements, quantitative measurements. So if you want to measure temperature, maybe you're looking at a drug that's going to decrease the temperature to control somebody's temperature. How would you do that? Would you just put your hand on their forehead and say, hot, cold, normal? You would use a thermometer, an instrument, and hopefully you've calibrated that instrument so that you know that it is accurate and precise. And the other thing is, right, who's ever doing these measurements should do it blindly. That means that they should not know anything about the experiment. They should not know ahead of time what person belongs to the experimental group or what person belongs to the control group. Because just with that knowledge, a person might influence or try to influence the results of that particular study. All right, so scientific studies are done blindly. And then, since you have nice quantitative information, the data is analyzed using very precise mathematical methods that we call statistics. So again, no observer bias can enter into the results. All right, so that's the process for testing a hypothesis. All right, and if you go through all this trouble right here, why do people go through all that trouble? What's the bottom line again for a scientific method? Reliable information that you can count on. That's the real important thing to know. Okay, so just to recapitulate a little bit, scientific method gives us reliable information. It's important in this class because the information in your book is what? Reliable or unreliable? It's reliable because it's been proven by scientific method. If you really want to go back and look in the literature, you can find the studies that have been repeated by the various labs to show that. But that's really not the purpose of this class. Okay, just to break that information down into nice bullet points for you. All right, so scientific method can be used to develop new drugs. All right, so when a new drug is suggested by experiments, its effectiveness and toxicity is tested first, right? So it's got to be both safe and effective, right? If a drug is safe but doesn't do its job, then there's no sense using it. If a drug does its job but it's not safe, then, of course, we can't use it on people either. So how do we get a drug available for human use? Well, first, this drug is used on just cells, which is a tissue. Anybody remember a definition of a tissue? It's just a group of cells with a similar structure and function, right? So it's a very well characterized mass of living cells, right? And if it works in tissues, right, a tissue culture, then the drug can be then used on other experimental models, like rats or mice, for instance, right? And all these rats are going to be basically the same genetic makeup. Right, and all these mice in that group are going to be the same genetic makeup. Right, and if it's safe and effective in all of these different experimental models, then right, it can be tried out in the human population. But this is the process, right? So here's the FDA process for actually bringing a drug to market, all these different phase trials. All right, so we need to show that it is safe and effective for people, all right? But you already have a lot of a priori information. You know it's been safe and effective on, what, living cells and different kinds of animals. These phase one trials, right, take normal, healthy human volunteers, right? And the toxicity and metabolism, safety and effectiveness is examined with healthy volunteers. Because if the drugs were to produce a harmful effect or deleterious effect, this would be the population that would be able to, what, withstand that kind of challenge, and these people wouldn't be hurt. As opposed, if you give a drug that you don't know if it works or not to somebody that's sick, what might happen? They might be so sick that it might actually kill them or hurt them in some way, right? So the healthy people would be able to withstand that kind of challenge. And if it passes the phase one, it goes on to phase two, right? Now you can start to deal with people that are sick, right, but a very limited target population. And if you don't cause any problems, and if it's meaning safe, and if the drug works, then you can move on to phase three trials, which is a more widespread population. And of course, you're keeping data all the time on all of these patients all the time. And if it's safe and effective with a large population, then it goes on and it's released to the general population. But in every particular case, right, the history of the drug is maintained by the FDA, and if there's any harmful effects ever to surface, the FDA knows about it, if it is an FDA-approved drug, as opposed to... Oh, that's why the computer was acting funny. It was downloading some information from the web, but hopefully I won't have to restart. If you see that sign, let me know, because if I don't say reboot later, it will just automatically reboot if I'm not looking at the screen. Okay, so FDA-approved drugs, unlike food supplements, are monitored for the whole lifespan of that particular drug, constantly looking to see if it is safe and effective. So FDA approval of drugs is very important, and you should be relatively assured that these drugs are both safe and effective. A really good example of how people follow up with drugs all the time, there was a drug that's called diethylstilbestrol, DES, and it was used to help women who were losing pregnancies midterm to help them go to term with their pregnancies. Now, does that sound like a nice drug if you were having trouble, if you were faced with miscarriage after miscarriage after miscarriage? And it definitely helped. All right, so it was very effective. But years later, we found out that women that were born to mothers that were on DES developed cervical cancer. All right, and that's not a good thing. And so what you can imagine what happened to diethylstilbestrol, DES. It was withdrawn from the market, okay, because the FDA keeps records of all of these things, right, pretty much in perpetuity. So using scientific method and these very precise methods, right, really reduces a lot of misery and death in our population. So it's very important. The other important thing about this example is that maybe this is the first time you're aware of that something that your parents do can affect your health. All right, so it is true that certain drugs maybe that you're taking can affect your offspring. All right, so this is another example of that. So that's another important reason to have the FDA, and I guess that's just kind of a word of caution of using experimental drugs in your own life, because it might not have just an effect on you, it might have an effect on your children later. Okay, so that's the scientific method. And we come to, I guess, the first big word in our class, homeostasis. And this is kind of a difficult concept, I think. Took me years and years to understand what homeostasis means. But that's really pretty much what your whole lab is about this week, is to understand something about homeostasis. All right, it means staying the same. How do things stay the same in your body? All right, homeostasis really is a condition in which a bunch of body parameters, right, will fluctuate inside your body to produce a healthy state. All right, we call that a range that's suitable to support life. So some of these parameters would be your body temperature. All right, and we all know something about body temperature. And as a matter of fact, if you're not in a disease state, what would be your temperature, your body temperature? Yeah, 98.6. And if I said, okay, everybody run up and down these stairs 20 times, guess what's going to happen to your body temperature? It's actually going to go up. All right, but homeostasis means that there are mechanisms inside your body that are going to become activated so that your temperature doesn't rise up so high, maybe 110 degrees, that's going to produce death. Some things are going to happen to lower your body temperature back down to where it should be. So for instance, what would that be? You're going to start sweating, okay? But now, in order to maintain your physiology in a proper range, you have to have other things that are correct. Not just temperature, but blood pressure has to be maintained. The pH, which is the measure of acidity, and the fluid content of your body has to be maintained within a narrow range, right? But as you start to run and your body temperature goes up, you said you start to sweat, which means what happens to your body fluids? They start to decrease, but when your body fluids decrease by sweating, your temperature goes back down to a normal level, right? But now your fluids are imbalanced. So what happens when your fluids are imbalanced? You have this sense of thirst, right? And you drink some fluids. All right, so now you can see that all of these parameters with your daily existence have to change and fluctuate, and they're all changing and fluctuating, but how are they doing it? They're doing it only in, what, a very small range. If body temperature drastically changes or your fluid level drastically changes, that's going to produce a disease state and you might die. But homeostasis just means that all of these factors are going to change, compensating for changes in other parameters or factors inside your body, so that everything is changing, so that nothing has to change by a large degree or change by a lot. All right, so that's the thing about homeostasis. Everything is changing so that nothing has to change by a lot. And so when I think of homeostasis and all these parameters, I actually see it as a dance. It's a dance of pH, salt concentration, glucose concentration, blood pressure. Everything is fluctuating all the time so that nothing changes drastically. All right, so it's kind of a weird concept. All right, but it's something that you have to pay attention to. So homeostasis is what we call a dynamic state. Right? It tries to maintain constancy, but nothing can remain constant. Everything has to fluctuate a little bit so that nothing goes far beyond normal. So one of the ways that your body controls itself, controls these fluctuations, is through reflexes. So let's talk about some reflexes. And some of these figures are not in your textbook. And some might be exam figures, so make sure that you do have copies of these figures, right? So I provide them to you in the PowerPoint. All right, so long-range reflexes. That means many, many cells. It could be a foot long or meters away. One cell is going to affect changes in other cells that are very distant from each other. So here is a cell that secretes a hormone. Anybody know what kind of cell this is? Cover it a little bit in anatomy. This is an endocrine cell. All right, so an endocrine cell is a cell that secretes a product, right, secretes it into the interstitial space outside the cell, and then that product or chemical gets picked up by a blood vessel. And what kind of blood vessel can pick up a chemical? In this particular case, a hormone. There's only one kind of blood vessel. What are the kinds of blood vessels you got in your body? Come on, you guys just took anatomy. Boom. What do you got? What takes blood away from the heart? Artery. Good. Okay, so that's one kind of vessel. What's another kind? Veins. Brings blood back, and then capillaries in between. Exchange, which means molecules entering the blood or leaving the blood, can only happen in which one of those vessels? Capillaries, and you should probably know why. I won't tell you why right now, but if you want to know later, I'll tell you. Unless somebody knows right now. Why is that so? Yeah, because capillaries are thin. Other blood vessels are way too thick to allow things to move in and out of them. Okay? So go back and look at your anatomy book. All right, so now you got this hormone in this blood vessel, and where does it go when it's in the blood vessel? everywhere in your body except, this isn't really a mind tweezer, teaser. It goes everywhere in your body except where? Epithelium, because epithelium doesn't have blood vessels. Maybe that rings a little bell. But it goes everywhere in your body, and it can then diffuse out of the blood via what kind of vessel? Another capillary someplace, right? That's the only way to get in and out of the blood is through a capillary. And then it's going to affect this target cell, and it's going to change the metabolism of this target cell. This cell is going to do something different that it can't do unless it gets this signaling molecule, this hormone. All right, so this is a typical endocrine pathway. Now, not every cell in your body can be a target cell. Only certain ones will be affected by this hormone right here. And you should know eventually, why do we call this a target cell? Why can it be aware of this hormone? Why can it, euphemistically speaking, why can it listen for this hormone? Or when that hormone is present, why does this target cell change its behavior? It's got to have something. And we're going to talk a lot about receptors. It's got to have a receptor to this particular molecule right here. If it doesn't have a receptor, then it cannot respond to this hormone. So that's what determines whether a cell is a target cell or target tissue to this hormone, if it has the proper receptor. It's a structure, right? And if we take that receptor, if we modify the structure of this cell, we take the receptor out, what else happens? The function changes because we've changed the structure. So you have to make a little bit of a transition in this class from looking at gross anatomy to even the structure of submicroscopic particles like molecules. Okay? Okay. Here's another reflex where we have a nerve cell. It's going to secrete a product. Oh, no, don't restart. Later. All right, and this particular product is not a hormone because it's secreted by not an endocrine cell, but what do we call a nerve cell? This particular kind, by shape. That is that's a neuron, and in particular, that's a nice multipolar neuron, right? So you should look at your cell types. That's a nice multipolar neuron. It secretes a neurotransmitter from the axon terminus right here. That neurotransmitter doesn't go into the blood. It's going to affect a neighboring cell, but in order for this neurotransmitter to have an effect on this neighboring cell right here, what does it have to have? It's got to have a receptor to this particular neurotransmitter. And we call this a long-range reflex because this axon right here is not microscopic, right? It can be a meter long or longer. So this is a long-range situation, okay, because of this long axon. Even though the neurotransmitter doesn't move very far, the information travels very far down this neuron. All right, then in a couple cases in the body, this is a really interesting case. We have a neuron, and this one can be relatively short. It doesn't necessarily have to go from your brain all the way down to the tip of your big toe, right? But it secretes something. What do we call a signaling molecule that's secreted by a neuron? We call it a neurotransmitter. But in this particular case, this neurotransmitter gets picked up by a capillary and is delivered all over the body. All right, so now this particular signaling molecule, is it acting like a neurotransmitter or is it acting like a hormone? It's acting like both of them, right? So in this particular case, the more sophisticated way of talking about this signaling molecule is that it is a neurohormone. It has properties of both, right? And we're going to talk about some important neurohormones. And why does this target tissue right here respond to this neurohormone? Because it has a receptor to that particular molecule. And it's a different receptor, for instance, than the one in this target tissue. So these hormones and neurohormones can have very opposite effects because these target tissues will have different receptors. Okay. There are some short-range reflexes. All right. And here's a couple different kinds of signaling molecules that I want you to be aware of. A paracrine agent is secreted by a local cell. Right. It can be like an endocrine cell. Right, and that paracrine agent diffuses through a very short range to a neighboring cell that has a receptor for it, therefore we call it a target tissue, and so this local cell can change the behavior of a neighboring salvia, a paracrine agent. So you should see a similarity between endocrine and paracrine type signaling molecules. The difference is a paracrine is what? Locally, does it have to go into the blood? An endocrine signaling molecule has to do what? Travel to a distant site via the cardiovascular system. Another mode of operation is when there is a signaling molecule that is released by the cell, right? It can actually go back and bind to a receptor on the same cell that secretes it, changing the behavior of this cell, right? And we call that an autocrine agent. So here you have a number of signaling molecules. Some are long range, some are short range. Some can even affect their own behavior. All right, so I'm sure these are all exam figures. So in an exam figure, I would maybe photocopy this and put it on the test and then white out, okay, this item right here. And then from a list, you would have to pick, right? What would you pick? Hormone, neurohormone, autocrine? You would pick paracrine, right? So this is just a graphical way that I like for you to learn and test you on. All right, and how should most people do? Some people are not visual learners. Most people do pretty well visually, right? But if you are a visual learner, what kind of score should you get on this kind of visual part of your lecture exam? You should clean it, right? Which means what? 100%. So that gives you some breathing room on other parts of the test. Now, not all of us are visual learners, but that's okay because then you can do well on the other parts of the test that aren't so visual. Right, so there's something on the test, there's something for everybody. The other thing is, though, it really helps if you're a visual learner because you can use the figures that are on the exam to help you answer the multiple choice questions as well. Right, so that's another reason to just become 100% familiar with all the graphics that are in the study guide in Blackboard. All right, so homeostasis uses these signaling compounds. signaling molecules to maintain a state of dynamic constancy. All right, and so here we see what homeostasis maintains. All right, and it does it through feedback loops, which we're going to look at, and in particular, negative feedback loops. So we see a particular parameter right here, and here is the average value. This is what we call the set point. All right, so that if we were to measure everybody in the room, we would come up with this number right here. This is just a normal average value. All right, some people might be up over here or down over here, but not beyond these dotted lines. What does it mean if you're beyond these dotted lines right here? You're in a disease state, or maybe you're even dead. Okay, but if your body can compensate for changes, right, if a parameter increases, your body is going to change, and it's going to bring that parameter back down to the set point. And it might overshoot a little bit. Okay, decrease the value of that parameter, but other things are going to change in your body to bring it, what, back up to the set point. So if the parameter is always moving back to the set point, that is brought about by a kind of feedback that I give this minus sign right here, which is called negative feedback. So negative feedback maintains a parameter within what kind of range? A normal range. So negative feedback usually produces a disease-free, healthy state. The other kind of feedback, guess what another kind of feedback is? Positive feedback. Positive feedback means when there is a change from the set point, your body adjusts but makes the change greater, which then makes the change greater, which then makes the change even greater. So positive feedback leads to a disease state, and indeed, if it moves so far away from the set point, it might actually produce death, right? So negative feedback normally produces a disease-free state. Positive feedback produces a disease state. And of course, you can imagine, what's the point of medicine? To enhance negative feedback loops and to abruptly stop positive feedback loops, right? Because that's going to produce death or a disease state. We want to maintain people in the normal range for various things. Like, give me some things that should be maintained in the normal range. What are some items? pH, fluid balance, electrolytes, which we'll talk about a little bit, glucose levels, blood pressure, for instance, right? All right, so that's what is necessary to maintain homeostasis. It's maintained by negative feedback loops. All right, so let's look at this little diagram right here. And let's look at a particular parameter. This could be blood glucose, could be temperature, pH, or it could be salt concentration inside your body. And let's just say that it's going to change. It's going to increase. How do you know? Or maybe it could be light, all right? How about if we walk in the room, how are you going to know if the lights are on or not? What do you have to have? Okay, and generally, what is an eye? What's in an eye? What's in your eyeball? You've got, yeah, rods and cones. These are sensors or receptors, right? In order for your body to appreciate a particular energy, a modality of energy, you need to have a sensor for it. All right, so for light, you need photoreceptors. What about for temperature? What do you need? Thermoreceptors, like they're free nerve endings in your skin. If you touch something, you can tell if it's hot or cold. But if you don't have those free nerve endings, maybe that nerve got damaged, you could touch something, and what can you tell me about the temperature? If that nerve is gone, damaged, or whatever. You have no idea. The tissue damage will still take place if it's hot or very, very cold, but you just can't tell, right? So a feedback loop needs a sensor to measure that information. And then it sends that information via this afferent pathway into an integration center. And this integration center, a lot of times, is your brain, maybe the medulla, right, or the hypothalamus, or the pons. And the integration center gets information from all over your body, adds it together, and it's going to compare it to what the normal value is. The normal value, I think I had on the previous slide, is what we call what? The set point. Right? So the set point is the normal value. And if the sensor is sending information to the integration center and says that this parameter is right at the set point, what does the integration center do? Right, if this X right here is exactly what it should be, what does the integration center do? It does nothing, right? Because you're perfect, right? So the integration center makes a decision on what to do based on the information that it's getting from the sensor. But if this value right here is different than the set point, what does the integration center do? It makes a decision to bring that parameter back down to what the set point is, or back up to what the set point is. It makes a decision, sends it out the efferent pathway to an effector organ. That effector organ then makes a change in this parameter, and you can see the relationship of these two arrows right here. Number one is what we call the stimulus, right? What picks up a stimulus? It's a sensor for that particular energy right here, right? And this effector is going to, right, is it going to add to the stimulus or subtract from it? Can you see the sense of these arrows right here? They're opposite to each other. One arrow is pointing up, the other arrow is pointing down. All right, so that means that they're going to subtract from each other. And if they subtract from each other, what kind of feedback is that? That's negative feedback. So what we see with this parameter X, it starts to increase. This increase right here is what we call the stimulus. It's picked up by the sensor. And then the integration center makes a decision to, right, bring the parameter back down into the normal range. Right? So this is what we call, right, the effect or the response. Right? So a feedback loop always starts with a stimulus and it ends with a response. And that's what produces homeostasis. So a good question right here is X constant over time? Is X constant? If you look at it, it's this value here, but at this point in time, it's what? Way up over here. So is X constant? X is changing all the time, but it's changing in such a way that what? It produces a healthy state. That's the point of homeostasis, and in particular, negative feedback loops. So this figure right here is not in your textbook. Yeah. This set point right here, really difficult for people, for science or medicine to know how to change this set point. Okay? Some drugs can. A really good example of being able to artificially manipulate this set point would be an antipyretic agent like aspirin, which you use to reduce your body temperature. All right, so when you have an infection, this set point in the hypothalamus says, oh, you need to go to a higher temperature to help fight that infection, right, which makes you feel miserable. You take an aspirin, it changes the set point right here so that your body temperature goes back down to normal. You feel better, you're a little bit more functional. All right. So changing the set point will definitely change your physiology in a really drastic way. A lot of drugs, we don't know how to get at that set point. We change other things about this afferent pathway or efferent pathway or something about the effector, but your body still knows what the set point should be, and it's going to compensate and still try to produce a disease state. So that's one of the interesting things about aspirin or other kinds of antipyretics, right? It bypasses all of this information and it changes the set point to where it should be to produce a healthy state. That sort of relates to your question, but ask me your question one more time and maybe I can nail it down. Okay, feedback loops, either positive or negative. Is it true that a negative always produces a healthy state, and is it true that a positive feedback always produces a disease state? No absolutes. You're going to learn maybe three or four positive feedback loops, maybe even in this chapter, that are normal, but they can only operate for a short period of time. And so they're a normal state. I'll mention some of those. So there's a couple, and then they have to go away. Otherwise, yeah, you would blow up one way or another. Okay? Okay. All right, so here's a really good, this is an exam figure. You guys in lab probably will go over this. So this is a response loop, or you maybe could consider this a reflex arc or a reflex loop, but probably in this class just call it a response loop. And a response loop always starts with what? A stimulus. It's going to be a change in some kind of parameter, right? And in order to appreciate a stimulus, what do you have to have? Stimulus or a receptor for it. Right, if for some reason you got into some really nasty caustic chemicals and it burned all of your olfactory nerves, right, and if somebody in your house says, pulls something out of the refrigerator and says, smell this for me, is it okay to eat this? Has it gone bad? But you know you don't have any olfactory neurons left. Can you tell somebody if that food has gone bad or not? No, right, because you know what the sense of olfaction is. You need those receptors, right? Those receptors send information via afferent neurons, which go which way? Periphery to central nervous system, that's an afferent neuron. That takes it to the central nervous system where you have an integration center. Integration center is used for what? Analysis and making a decision. If this stimulus is driving the system away from the set point, the integration center is going to try to figure out a way to bring that parameter back down toward a normal level. Right? If you're hot, it's going to make you sweat. If you're cold, it's going to make you shiver. Right? So the integration center can do different things depending on what information it's getting from this sensor. But it's got to send that information out the efferent pathway, which is what? CNS to periphery to an effector organ. All right? And that effector organ is going to produce a response. And in most cases, 99% of the time, this feedback loop, the response is going to do what? Subtract from the stimulus, bringing that parameter back down to a set point. Okay, so what kind of effector organs are there? I know this is after a long break, but let's organize some anatomy really quick. What kind of effector organs do you have? Let's start with four of them. What kind of muscle? Skeletal muscle is one. Controlled by your somatic nervous system. We got some other effectors. What are some other effectors you got? Smooth muscle, controlled by your autonomic nervous system. Cardiac muscle, controlled by your autonomic nervous system. And glands, right? Glands, controlled by your autonomic nervous system. So there's only one thing that you have voluntary control over to produce a voluntary response. And what's that? Skeletal muscle is the only thing you have control of in your body. Everything else is controlled automatically or autonomically. All right, so make sure you know these components of the response loop and their correct order. Right? Don't say stimulus, right? Then you have a response right here because you're missing all these steps. Make sure you know all these steps. And a good way to get started is by saying a response loop always starts with a stimulus and it always ends with a response, but don't forget about all these other important steps in between. Okay? And during the course, we're going to look at, well, what is the efferent pathway? What is the afferent pathway? What is the integration center? What is the set point for a number of response loops in your body? All right, so we've talked about this already, types of feedback. Basically, there's two, negative feedback, positive feedback. Negative feedback is some kind of mechanism that blunts a change. It resists a change in your body. Right? It moves the system back to the set point. Positive feedback is something that moves that parameter farther and farther away from the set point. That's why it usually produces a disease state. And in terms of temperature, if there's a positive feedback mechanism operating in your body in terms of temperature, can that produce a disease state or a fatal state? Happens all the time, unfortunately, when people become hyperthermic. Right? Every year there are high school athletes, college athletes, and even every once in a while professional athletes. I forgot if somebody died this year of hyperthermia, professional athletes that get out on the football field in August when it's super, super hot and they want to become a super athlete and their body gets drained of electrolytes and fluids and they can't cool their body down anymore because they've lost all the fluids already. And then basically burn up inside when they reach temperatures, I don't know what temperatures they can reach, 108, 110 degrees, and they get to the point to where medicine can't even help them and they die of hyperthermia, right? So that would be an example of a positive feedback mechanism. Okay, a couple of different ways that organs can regulate themselves. One is called an intrinsic control mechanism. Intrinsic control means that the organ itself has built into it ways that it auto-regulates. And a really good example of this is the heart. The heart can adjust its force of contraction, the way that it contracts, depending on how much blood is presented to it. As more blood flows back to the heart gets stronger so that it can pump more blood because it's receiving more blood. Right? We call that the Frank Starling Law. There's also part of the Frank Starling Law that says as blood flow to the heart is reduced, the heart gets weaker. It doesn't produce the same amount of force. Right? That's an intrinsic property of the heart. Really important to know that because if somebody's hemorrhaging and they're losing blood, you have less blood going back to the heart. What happens to the heart all by itself because of the intrinsic property of the heart? It gets weaker and weaker and weaker, can't maintain blood pressure, and of course, right, that's a positive feedback mechanism, and that's going to kill that person. Unless you can get some blood flowing back to the heart, and then the heart gets stronger and stronger and stronger. So, for instance, if somebody hemorrhaged due to an automobile accident on the way to the hospital, what can we do for patients? We can start up an IV. Can't transfuse them, but we can give them fluids in their blood. That fluid is going to go back to the heart, and it's going to make the heart stronger and keep them out of cardiovascular collapse, okay, due to that just intrinsic mechanism of the heart, the Frank Starling Law. Extrinsic control comes from outside the organ. That means that there has to be other organs that can maintain, that have to work together in concert with each other to maintain homeostasis. All right, so for a good example of that is that body temperature. All right, is controlled by two effects in your body. Sweating, where do you sweat from? Your skin, your integument, right? And that's only on the surface of your body. It doesn't have anything to do with the temperature of your brain, for instance, which is very important to control, right? So the brain doesn't control your body temperature. It has to work with your integument. But if you get cold, your integument can't increase your body temperature. The brain has to ask for help from muscles, skeletal muscles, that will bring your body temperature up. So the brain temperature is being maintained by the integument, and muscles, and there has to be interconnections between the two, and so we call that extrinsic regulation. All right, the brain can't regulate its own temperature. It needs help from other organs to do that. All right, so if we look at this graph of temperature versus time, you see if somebody's body temperature decreases, right, you're going to start to shiver. That's going to bring your body temperature back up to the set point. What kind of feedback loop is operating here? It is negative feedback. It's maintaining a disease-free state or a healthy state. And as you get too hot, right, you start to sweat. That brings your temperature back down. Again, a negative feedback mechanism. Okay, maintaining your temperature, not constant, but within what? A normal range that's suitable to support your life. Okay. Here is another example. This particular one, extrinsic mechanism. If we look at a plot of glucose, blood glucose concentration versus time, all right, it's normal blood glucose is going to be right around 100 milligrams per deciliter in blood, okay, as long as you don't have diabetes or some disease state. If that door is, if those students are obnoxious out there, you can close that door for me if you want to. Or just yell, shut up. Okay, so we can see that your blood glucose is pretty constant, fluctuating a little bit over here. But if we inject insulin, look what happens to blood glucose concentration. It's going to plummet. Okay, so for instance, if somebody is a diabetic and they're hypoglycemic, they can measure their glucose in their blood. If they're hypoglycemic, meaning the glucose level is low, is that when a diabetic would want to give themselves an insulin shot? Absolutely not, because it will make their blood glucose go even lower. So when somebody is hypoglycemic, what's a good way to treat hypoglycemia? You should have some food, right? You should eat something. Oh, they didn't close the door. Yeah, go ahead, maybe close that door right there. Or close it and yell, shut up. Okay, so here is some exogenous treatment, right? That we artificial treatment that we have applied to some mammal someplace, and insulin causes a drop in blood glucose, right? But then what happens to blood glucose levels? This is just one shot, not a continuous shot. What happens to blood glucose level if this is a normal, healthy individual? It's going to go back to the set point. And we're going to talk about some mechanisms where that happens. There are a number of organs that are involved, like the pancreas is involved, the liver is involved, and since you have a number of organs at distant locations from each other being coordinated, right, through hormones and even through the nervous system, what kind of control is that? Intrinsic or extrinsic? Organs far apart from each other, controlling each other would be extrinsic regulation. Okay, if the blood all by itself was able to regulate blood glucose without the help of any other organs, that would be intrinsic regulation. Right, but this requires other organs. All right, so here we see the parameter going back to the set point. So what kind of feedback is operating in this part of the graph? Positive or negative? Negative, because it's going back to the set point. If it was positive, what would happen? Glucose would get lower and lower and lower and lower, and that would be a terrible thing. Okay? Okay. Okay, here are a couple examples of positive feedback. This is, somebody had a good question about this. Positive feedback is rare because it what? Amplifies changes. It continues the change in the same direction that it was taking place. All right, when you cut yourself, all right, and blood is leaking out of your body, is it a good thing that we stop that bleeding right away, or can you live with it for a couple days? It's best to stop it as soon as possible. There's a positive feedback mechanism that engages itself very rapidly so that you stop bleeding right away. As a matter of fact, within minutes, depending on the size of the blood vessel. But there's only a couple blood vessels that you can't stop from bleeding just with finger pressure. Okay? If you can stop that bleeding, blood clotting is going to take over and that blood vessel's eventually going to be fine. So production of blood clots. When we get to blood, I'll show you exactly where that positive feedback mechanism is. All right, so try to keep that in the back of your mind. But that does what? That positive feedback in this case is good because it stops you bleeding in a hurry, right? It prevents blood loss in a hurry. Okay. In women, All right, there is a hormone called luteinizing hormone, or LH, and it's used to cause ovulation. LH comes from the brain or pituitary, and that causes ovulation in the ovary. Right? LH increases, and that causes a maturation of an oocyte. It gets bigger. I suppose you could think of it stronger. A follicle gets bigger and stronger, and it causes an increased secretion in LH, right, which causes that follicle to get bigger and stronger, which causes LH to increase, the levels of LH to increase in a woman's body. Okay? All right, so, and then when the follicle is mature, it ovulates, it spits the egg out of the ovary, right, and then whatever happens after it's maybe fertilized or not fertilized at that particular point. Okay? But since this is a good positive feedback necessary to cause ovulation, all right? So we said that positive feedback drives something farther and farther away from the set point. Well, how is it that the whole universe isn't filled up with LH? If LH secretion causes even more LH, which causes more LH secretion, which causes more LH secretion, how come the whole universe isn't filled up with luteinizing hormone? Because it's a positive feedback system right here. Because ovulation happens, right? Something does blow up, something does explode, and when that explosion takes place, that immediately causes a suppression of LH from being secreted. So when you have a positive feedback mechanism, something has to change drastically to break that positive feedback mechanism if it's going to remain a normal disease-free state. Okay. Another example of positive feedback between the fetus, right, and the mother, right, during that actually controls parturition or the process of being born. Right, oxytocin is from the female, from the mom, right, and it stimulates smooth muscle to contract. Right, there's another hormone that is secreted by the fetus, and it's a cortisol kind of hormone. Cortisol is No, restart later. Thank you. All right. So as the fetus gets larger and larger and larger inside a woman's uterus, how do they feel? Like when they're this big and they're in a uterus this big, how do they feel? Plenty of room to run around in there, right? Okay. Now when the fetus is this big and the uterus is about this big, how does the fetus feel? Can't play soccer in there. You're really confined, right? Your stress levels go way up. And as the fetal stress levels go way up, they secrete cortisone. And that cortisone then is monitored by the mom. There are receptors in the hypothalamus that release oxytocin. That oxytocin causes smooth muscles to contract. So what happens to the uterus? It shrinks down. Okay, what happens to the fetus? All right, or they're even under more stress, so they secrete more cortisone, which causes more oxytocin secretion, which causes more cortisone, which causes more oxytocin. So how come the whole universe isn't filled up with oxytocin? What happens? Well, boom, now you got this baby you got to take care of, right? Okay. All right, so positive feedback is normal under certain circumstances, but not for the duration of somebody's life, right? Only for, sorry about that, maybe the door is locked, only for a short period of time. Okay. So regulatory mechanisms, and let's talk about blood pressure. Here's a pretty good response loop. Oh, they were just kidding. Okay. All right, let's take a person that's lying down. You're almost lying down right now. You're sitting down. Okay, you're not exercising. You might have, maybe you can wedge it or something, I'm not sure. All right, and when somebody goes from a lying down or seated position to standing up, your blood pressure is going to decrease. Even after lecture, you stand up, your blood pressure is going to decrease. Some of you might get a little woozy, okay, when you do that, even more so when you get stand up from a lying down position. But in probably most of us in here, you're not going to pass out, which is a really good thing. Because if you pass out when you stand up, what's going to happen? Well, your head is going to bounce off the table, and then it's going to bounce off the chair, and then it's going to bounce off the floor. Okay, so it's really a nasty thing. So it's good to maintain your blood pressure so you don't pass out. All right, so that change in blood pressure is what we call a, because it's going to start a response loop. All right, so what do you have in order for your body to measure blood pressure in your body or respond to blood pressure? it's got to have a receptor for it. There are what we call baroreceptors. These are receptors in your body that measure blood pressure. They're in your neck, okay? They're around your heart. So those are the sensors. And it sends that information via afferent nerves to the medulla oblongata, which is the, what we got in the medulla oblongata? The most general name for this center there that is monitoring blood pressure is called the integration center. If you want to get a little bit more particular, we call it the cardioregulatory center, or the cardiac center, or the vasomotor center. You put them together, that's the cardioregulatory center. It's going to say, your blood pressure is what, normal? Or you're going to say what in this particular case? Blood pressure is low. It's abnormal. Got to do something, right? The integration center makes a decision on what to do, sends that information out. Efferent nerves, one place it goes to is the heart. What's your heart going to respond? How's it going to respond? This is what? An effector. Cardiac muscle is an effector. Force of contraction, maybe heart rate is going to increase. That's going to boost your blood pressure back up, right? And we see that the response increases blood pressure, but the stimulus was a decrease in blood pressure. How do you relate these two? Are they adding or subtracting from each other? They're subtracting, so what kind of feedback loop is that? That's a nice negative feedback loop that prevents you from passing out when you stand up. Oh, rats, I forgot something today. The sign-in sheet. I think it's too late for me to pass the sign-in sheet around. Who's got a class right afterwards? Number of people. All right, we got to remind me to pass the sign-in sheet around because it's going to take more than just a couple minutes. All right, well, here's the last slide. And I'm going to start with this slide next time, but you got to remind me to pass the sign-in sheet around. So attendance is very important in every class. And you have to sign the sign-in sheet in order to get credit for being in class. If you say you forgot to sign the sign-in sheet, but you were in class, what does that mean to me?
Nothing.
You weren't in class, because I can't remember who's in class or not. Okay. It's too late. Yeah. Maybe I can show you.